pull up. So any second, but we can get started just explaining what we're going to be talking about today. Okay, we are talking about myths about Bitcoin. So when we, hold on one second. All right, I did the rookie mistake where I could hear myself like three times. Okay. So when we talk about Bitcoin myths, we're talking about the things that people see in the news, on Twitter, all over the place. And you think like, you know what? I think that this seems like it's probably legit. It comes from a legitimate news source or somebody that I trust. And we're thinking that these stories that people are telling us are accurate. And oftentimes the stories are really, really negative. And so as somebody who hears about Bitcoin, but maybe doesn't understand it, we think, yeah, Bitcoin is XYZ, and that XYZ is normally not like amazing and the best thing ever. And so what we want to do today is talk about the myths that we hear that we can clearly debunk because they are not true. And if you're a new listener, you can hear how we're explaining some of these so that when you hear these stories in the news, you're able to say, hey, wait a minute, let me back up and rethink if this is accurate or not. So I'm Jessica Levesque. I'm the executive director for C4, and we're really excited to have our CVP committee members here today and special guest Jameson Law. So let's start just by doing intros. Dirk, do you want to start as you are our committee chair?
Yeah, I'm Dirk Anderson. I'm the, as you said, the committee chair for the CVP committee. I also sit on the CCSS committee with Jameson. I am the chief technology officer at Salt Lending, which is a crypto-backed lending company. Jameson.
Very cool.
All right. Yeah, I'm Jameson Lopp, CTO, co-founder of Casa. We're a Bitcoin security service. We basically help people help themselves be their own banks. And I've been full-time in Bitcoin for 8 years now, really focusing on self-custody that entire time, just in different ways. And I also am on the CCSS advisory board.
Very cool. And thank you for joining another committee, Jameson, since you already joined the CCSS one. So we appreciate you hopping over to this one today. Rodney?
Hi, everyone. My name is Rodney McInnes. I am COO and AML Compliance Ninja at Outlier Solutions. We are AML compliance professionals within Canada and professional outcasts because we speak Bitcoin to regulators and we speak regulation to Bitcoiners. So nobody's our friend.
Oh, Rodney, I just want to give you a big hug when you say that.
Okay, I say Hunter? That with a lot of sarcasm. There's a tremendous support from both sides.
Yeah, I'm Hunter Albright. I'm an educator and advisor in the Bitcoin and crypto space. As Dirk had indicated, I have a traditional sort of background from traditional finance and payments, and I had served on the MasterCard Europe board of directors when I was living in Europe. And today I'm an educator and advisor for companies in the blockchain and crypto space and a proud member of the committee.
Awesome. Anita?
Yeah, hello. I think I'm the most recent member of the CBP. I'm honored to be here. And I'm a Bitcoin educator. I'm the founder of Bitcoin for Fairness. And I'm at the moment in Zimbabwe. So I'm traveling African countries, trying to foster grassroots adoption and education about Bitcoin. And I also wrote a book about Bitcoin and have a podcast.
Yeah, your book's behind me. All right, Janine.
Hi, my name is Janine, and I'm also on the committee. I write a newsletter called This Month in Bitcoin Privacy, and I am also on the board of OpenSats, which, among other nonprofits, helps raise money to support Bitcoin development, and most recently, the HODL Not Legal Defense Fund.
Awesome. So we have a great group here. Thank you all for taking the time to join today, volunteering with us so that we can teach other people what we know about Bitcoin. So I'd like to start by talking about a comment that was put on the Bitcoin Mythbusters 1 live stream. So a couple of weeks ago, we met, we did this, we talked about some other myths that happened and or that are occurring that people are wondering about. And there was somebody who posted a comment afterwards about what is crypto backed by? And it's talking about many claim that crypto is a commodity instead of a security. Some even joke that it is a commodity because crypto is backed by an expensive electric bill. So we wanted to answer this person, William Hung's question before we move into the other myths. So Dirk, did you want to start?
Well, I was actually going to let Jameson start because I thought he had a good point when we were discussing this beforehand.
Fair enough. Yeah. So, you know, what is Bitcoin backed by? Well, you know, there's a number of different angles you can take or approaches or perspectives of, you know, why does Bitcoin work or why does it have value? Obviously, there's cryptography, game theory, so on and so forth. But I think, you know, what this person is really asking is, you know, is there an intrinsic value to it? That's the common thing that people talk about of, you know, oh, for most of human civilization, money was backed by gold or some other like physical precious commodity. You know, it wasn't until more recently in history that we had fiat, which was just, you know, money created by decree of some authority. So the way that I've looked at it for quite a while is that, you know, what we're talking about here is not a monetary system that is issued, controlled, manipulated by any authority. Rather, it is a voluntary network. So the backing, while there are many different technical things that keep the network secure, the, you know, the underlying foundation of all of this is the humans behind the network. And so people who care about Bitcoin contribute to the system, and they can do so in a number of different ways. You know, perhaps they're coders, perhaps they're evangelists, perhaps they're running nodes and other parts of the actual technical infrastructure. But at the end of the day, the network is backed by the people who care about it and want to see it continue to operate and succeed. And so that's why these networks cannot die until everyone agrees that they're dead and they're not worth trying to sustain anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why I wanted Jameson to go. and I think
Did you have anything to add?
If that's what it is, right? I mean, whether you call it a commodity or a security really has no relevance on how it's used and what it actually is, right? I mean, those are just regulatory terms that get applied to it. And as Rodney mentioned before we started the call, they're going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as well. So it's not even going to be the same thing in one jurisdiction that is in another. Because and part of that is, you know, with new technology, you're always figuring it out. Although, you know, I feel like after a decade, you stop calling it new technology, but maybe not. And so that, yeah, the nomenclature of what it is doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what actually makes it work.
That's an interesting point. When does it stop being considered new? At what point is something no longer, I don't know. It's just like, yeah, when is this something, maybe when mass adoption happens or everybody knows about it? I'm not sure.
I think almost everybody has heard of Bitcoin at this point. I think the actual adoption rate is still probably 10% or lower globally. But one other metric to look at, if you're comparing it to currencies, last I checked, you know, the average fiat currency only lasts like 20 or 25 years. So let's give it another decade or so. And like once Bitcoin has survived longer than the average fiat currency, then we're really going.
That is a fascinating statistic and kind of terrifying.
I mean, I think that the discussion brings up a couple interesting points. One, if you look back at innovation, there's usually two key elements about innovation. One is how fast the technical solution gets invented and realized and is possible, right? And I think we have that has been proven with Bitcoin, and it gets proven really quickly in many respects with some technologies. But the socializing of it and the adoption and the willingness to trust it tends to be on a much slower and longer curve than sort of the feasibility of the technology. And while that curve is accelerating, and you can go back and look at sort of the adoption of technologies over time, I think in particular for crypto and for Bitcoin, it is a harder challenge for us and for the technology, because we're changing business models, we're changing representation, as Jameson brought up, right, in terms of consensus about how does the technology get controlled. But we're also then shifting people's concept of money. And so I think there's a lot of things at play that make it creates natural resistance in people to accept it before they're willing to adopt and try it. And what Anita's doing and many of us in terms of the educational efforts, I think is critical, because that is a key first step to letting people consider a different future than what the status quo is today.
Yeah, I think we could maybe take the analogy from the internet. I mean, when was the internet not new anymore? I mean, in 1997 to 2000, the internet was also new for most people. And actually, countries like in Africa, they were even lagging behind, because people here didn't trust the internet, because it's a white technology also, and which I in part understand. So it's also a regional difference. And I don't know, I mean, when was the internet for you not new anymore?
That's a good point too. Like, it depends on where we're talking about something, right? There's something becomes not a new technology for some people way prior to others, right? Like cryptographers and people who understand more of the technical side of things, many of them have been, like Jameson and Dirk, I think you were saying you've been familiar with Bitcoin for a lot longer than someone like me, who needed to wait until there was more information out there and it was explained in a way that someone who's not super technical can understand. And so actually that brings us into our first question, which is, do you need to be super technical to be able to use Bitcoin? And so I think we can continue with this analogy that you had, Anita, with the internet, and how we've kind of become used to the internet, and how we're becoming used to Bitcoin. So do we need to be super technical? Jameson, do you want to start?
Yeah, like any technology and the adoption curve that comes with it, it's a question of user experience. And so if anyone here was an extremely early adopter of the internet, if you used the internet in the late 80s or early 90s, if you were, you know, a dial-up user and you had to go buy one of these special modem cards to put into your computer so that you could then, you know, get onto a phone line and try to dial into some server at an extremely slow speed, you know, that is, I think, a good analogy if we're looking at, you know, how hard it is to onboard into new technologies, because generally new technologies, they come out and it's just sort of like the proof of concept. You know, the functionality is there, but we haven't smoothed out all the rough edges to make it easier for the average person. And, you know, what happens is you go through that adoption curve, and the earliest adopters will be the really technical, nerdy folks. They'll come in, they'll start using it, they'll see the value, they'll also see the rough edges, and some of them will start dedicating their time and skills and resources to smoothing out the rough edges. And I would say, you know, that's what I personally have been doing for the past 8 years, is seeing that the promise of being your own bank is a world-changing phenomenon. But from a practical standpoint, we're not going to change the world unless the average person can actually be their own bank and can be confident that they can be their own bank. Because, you know, we're we're empowering a lot of people, but with that power comes responsibility, and the responsibility and the foot guns are what scare people off. So, you know, I see Bitcoin as still fairly early in the adoption curve, but even just over the past 3 or 4 years, we've made great advances, and especially with people focusing more on things like retail payments and Lightning enabled apps. I feel like the user experience that we're seeing on the second layers, especially with Lightning stuff, a lot more care is being put into that user experience and making it a lot easier for people to onboard. So, you know, I think we are getting closer to the level of sort of call it Facebook or Instagram user experience, where the average person can install an app and just, you know, click a few buttons and get started. That's certainly still true if we're talking about playing around with small amounts of money. You know, if it's your pocket money, if it's something that you can afford to lose and it won't ruin your life, then yeah, I think that we are within reach of, you know, the average internet connected person being able to get onboarded and start using Bitcoin. I think that there's still a ways to go if we're talking about making it really easy for people to feel comfortable with setting up sort of cold storage solution where they have like their life savings and they're confident enough that nothing will go wrong there. But that just means that there's, you know, there's still a lot of opportunity for us to continue to grow and improve in the space.
I think it was interesting with Bitcoin too, that that early on it absolutely was all the tech people, right? But then we had that bull run in like end of 2017 into 2018 that brought money people into the game, right? All of a sudden you had all these, like, you know, finance and money type people, investors and stuff getting involved. And I think that that has helped maybe accelerate some of what Jameson's talking about there, right? Because there was not just a need, but a demand for, you know, tools that made it easier. And I think that has maybe helped in the last few years with that kind of simplification of adoption.
Anita, didn't you recently, like, aren't you seeing payments happening at grocery stores? Like, didn't you recently, I feel like you tweeted something where someone was actually, you can use Bitcoin now?
Yeah, that's right. So from my perspective here on the ground, I see that wallets that are like Lightning wallets, for instance, Wallet of Satoshi, I mean, okay, it's a custodial Lightning wallet, but still it's very easy to onboard people, even people who have no clue about Bitcoin. But I think the most important thing is to tell them how they can back up their at least custodial Lightning. And what you're referring to is 2 days ago, Pick n Pay, which is one of the biggest supermarket chains in South Africa, has started to accept Bitcoin payments, Lightning payments. And it's that way, in that sense, great, because they have one supermarket right next to Bitcoin Ekasi, the township where the surf coaches get paid in Bitcoin with Lightning. And they have onboarded 10 of the 17 small informal shops inside of the township to accept Bitcoin. But up until now, these shop owners had to exchange either to South African rand or to buy a Bitrefill voucher to be able to go to the supermarket to restock their goods. And now they don't have to do that anymore, and they just can go to Pick n Pay to get their things and their bread and their groceries. And I think that's a huge step also for Bitcoin being a money. And I think this earning and spending aspect is very, very important for adoption, even more in these countries where people don't have money that they can save. So the speculation effect or possibility is not that one that drives adoption here. I think it will be earning and paying with Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really cool. You said 10 out of 17 have adopted it, the stores. It's amazing to see that.
And it's the children. It's the children also from the township. They have they get smartphones lent out where they have their wallet of Satoshi, and they also when they go to school and they do the surfing, they here and there get some Satoshis. And they then also go to the shops and to Pick and Pay to buy a soft drink or things like that. So it's really children can do it.
Yeah, that's cool. And actually, this brings up another myth that we often hear, which is that in order to use Bitcoin, you have to have an entire Bitcoin. And you sort of started touching on this, Anita. But Janine, do you want to talk a little bit about Bitcoin in terms of how you actually use it? If you don't have, do you have to start with a whole Bitcoin? Can you start with less? Anita, you brought up Satoshis, but what is the difference and how do we, what is the divisibility in Bitcoin when we're using it as a currency?
Yeah, you can definitely start with less than a Bitcoin. I don't know if that's still a common misconception. It might be, but it definitely was still a few years ago where people thought that they had to get a whole Bitcoin. And so part of the myth of Bitcoin is too expensive has to do with the fact that people assumed they had to get a whole Bitcoin in order to use it. And you can obviously get less than that because one Bitcoin is made of Satoshis and there's 100 million Satoshis in each Bitcoin. And especially if you use something like the Lightning Network, then you can make it's very feasible to do very small payments in Bitcoin using that. So that makes it even easier for people, especially if they live in countries where the value of their national currency is a lot lower than the dollar or the euro or what have you. Then that makes it also easier for them to do commerce with smaller units than what many of us here would be using. So yeah, that is a common myth that Bitcoin is too expensive to use. A part of that is also to do with fees. And that could be a whole other discussion of why there's a myth about Bitcoin having high fees. And a lot of that has to do with certain wallets having very poor fee management because they have very poor coin management. And I mean, a related myth to that is that people don't understand really where fees come from. They think fees are just kind of arbitrary, or it's purely based on, for example, it's a combination of congestion in the network, and it's also mostly to do with how much data you're trying to send. So if your transaction sizes are huge because your wallet doesn't know how to construct transactions properly, then your transaction size will be larger than normal, and so you will have to pay a higher fee. It all has to do with the amount of data you're trying to send because the Bitcoin prices that directly. Because you obviously, there's an incentive to avoid creating unnecessarily large transactions in terms of the data size because, you know, we're all of the nodes on the Bitcoin network have to store this in the blockchain, and over time, if everybody is creating transactions that are too large in terms of the data size, then that means everybody has to be storing more and more data. And so there's a cost to not managing that well.
I also think we should talk about what is the difference between Bitcoin and Lightning. When we talk about Bitcoin and then we're talking about Lightning and micropayments, what does that mean? Can somebody jump in and explain that before we move on and keep talking about the divisibility?
We can, but it is also part of the scalability myth that we have on the list to talk about later.
Okay. Noted. Dirk, thank you. All right, then stay tuned. All right, so did anyone else want to say anything about the divisibility part before we move on to the next myth?
The only thing I want to add is I was shocked by the amount of people that had this misconception. We bought our business partner a shirt that says you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. I believe it was an Andreas, a shirt from Andreas's site. And he wore it around to Bitcoin meetups when, you know, around kind of 2018 when people started pouring in. And he was shocked by the amount of people that came up to him and started asking him questions. And he also had the additional misconception of thinking he didn't know much about Bitcoin, mainly because he hangs around folks who have been in around the space for quite some time. When he kind of interacted with the general population, he was kind of surprised with how much he actually knew. But yeah, I was pretty shocked by the amount of people that thought that you had to have a whole Bitcoin in order to do anything related to Bitcoin. So
that is such an interesting point. Like the idea of it's like a myth that people don't, some of us, I'm probably included in this, feel like we're phonies and don't know as much as we do because we spend time around people that know so much more. And so, yeah, that's, I haven't thought about that really. I know you and I have talked before about this a little bit, Rodney, but yeah, there is that myth that like, okay, I'm talking to Jameson and Jameson knows everything about Bitcoin, so I don't know anything. And it's like, okay, that's not necessarily true. Obviously, I don't know as much as Jameson, but like I do still have some information. And so if I do wear my, you can own only a fraction of a Bitcoin t-shirt and somebody comes up to me, it's not like I'm gonna be like, I'll be able to explain what the divisibility is and what sats are and that kind of a thing. So I feel like that's a good message for anybody who's listening too and wants to be able to feel more confident talking about it. Like if you do know that you know some of the facts, even if you don't know everything about it, and somebody asks you a question, you can always say what you know and then refer them to additional resources of people who do know, you know, more than maybe you do.
Yeah, and I think that that's totally true too. The divisibility, the value of a sat versus the value of a Bitcoin goes back to what Jameson was talking about earlier too, right? That if you want to learn, you can play with almost no money, right? You can, and particularly you get yourself, a decent Lightning wallet and you can play with, you can learn how it works without having to understand the cryptography, without having to understand all of these things. Fundamentally, you can learn how to use it and how it works functionally with very little money.
And that's going to be one of the best ways for the community to move forward is this practical experience of low risk transactions. You can play around, send stuff to friends, send stuff to family members, send stuff around the world, see how long it takes, try to work to understand it. And I do want to sort of make a shameless plug for C4 on the back of Jessica, what you were saying. I think for me, the community is fantastic. So, and nobody should be afraid to ask somebody, because I would say that the community are all advocates and enthusiasts of the applications and the technology and very willing to share information, to go down rabbit holes with questions that are interesting. And C4 is a great source for both that community as well as the resources from videos to training books. And then if you want to get certified, the courses, but a way to build up your knowledge, to feel more confident, but just to engage.
And I think along with that is the comfort to say, I don't know. It's okay to say, I'm not sure. This is, as we were discussing before, a new technology. And so it's okay to say, I don't know, and go look for you can go look for the answer together with that person, depending on the scenario. But this is going to be better than guessing, to be like, oh yeah, there's 100,000 Satoshi in every Bitcoin. Then you probably should have verified that response.
Yeah, and I would argue that the greatest challenge for the community, right, it is complex technology, and there are experts like Dirk and Jameson and others that really know the cryptography and all the network technologies as required. But as a community, our hardest challenge is how do we simplify it to really make it easy and for people to come on board and use? Because the populations that Anita are working with, people that are outside of the developed countries, are where, in many respects, in my opinion, we can make the biggest difference from a numbers of people and changing people's lives. And then that will start to trickle into the more developed countries as they sort of the technology gets proven out. And the opportunity to adopt it in sort of replace standardized payment systems, as an example, becomes more real.
May I add something too, please? So it's also a plug, but for C4 and Bitcoin for Fairness, actually we made together a Bitcoin flyer, Shanine also helped, where the idea behind it is to have a very cheap to produce flyer. It's just one page. You can copy it in a copy shop and then bring it to Bitcoin meetups so that people, I have the experience here, people come, they listen to my talk, they see my slides. I tell them, this is the website from Jameson. He has a lot of information. These are YouTube videos. But the people here, they don't have that internet access to watch YouTube videos, for instance. So I thought it would be a great idea just to have a handout for them so they can go home with a small flyer where we lay out the basics of Bitcoin, how it's not a scam, because most people here believe it's a scam. And we also put on how to install, for instance, the Blue Wallet and like on-chain wallet for savings and the Lightning Wallet for spendings and micropayments, and that you can find on the Bitcoin for Fairness website.
Yeah, I think that learning by doing is, I mean, that is a philosophy in teaching and learning, that if you are engaged and you're actually doing something, you're experiencing it, you're more likely to remember it and to really understand it. And I do think asking somebody, you know, either sending, you can send money back and forth, send Bitcoin to yourself from yourself to practice. And since you can do it with a really small amount and the transaction fees are very minimal, you can practice back and forth. Or like in, I think it was 2017, I asked Janine to help me and we set up a wallet and went back and forth, and it was a hardware wallet for the first time, and we just practiced from it. And it wasn't practice like her saying, send me your private keys. It was her just walking me through everything and having me feel more comfortable with using it. And it feels challenging, I think, at first, but it's challenging anytime you do something first. If you've never been into a grocery store before and you walk in and you're expected to make a payment, you don't know what to do if you've never seen your parents or guardian model this purchase before. So I think saying, I don't know, and accepting that you might feel kind of silly the first time you do something is the key to becoming comfortable doing it. And one of the things we often hear is, even if we're talking about a small amount or a large amount, is that it's not secure, right? So there's this fear that even if it's, you know, $5, $5 is $5, you know, $1 is $1. This is still money we're talking about. And so no matter what the amount is, we want to make sure that if we work hard for our money, which I assume most people do, that you then are sure that you're not going to lose it and it's not going to disappear overnight. And so one of the other myths that we hear about is that there are security issues and people are losing their Bitcoin and therefore the Bitcoin network isn't safe. And this is a myth. And Dirk, could you jump in and start explaining why this is a myth, that the Bitcoin network isn't secure?
Yeah, sure. And I do want to be clear, right, that there are risks, right? And you need to be careful. But the myth that Bitcoin is somehow inherently insecure is the myth, right? The cryptography behind it, the algorithms and the methodology with which it's applied, have been proven out over the last 12 years, right? And they are, and it utilizes, there was nothing like inherently new in the components that make up Bitcoin. It was the way they were put together and used that was new and innovative, but there was nothing really new in the actual like mathematical technologies behind it. When we hear about all of these, you know, thefts and compromises and stuff like that, it's really no different than somebody hacking a banking website or something, right? If you're utilizing some sort of, and this is why Jameson will get very detailed in the managing your own keys and your own wallets and being your own bank. But if you're utilizing exchanges where you're trading one crypto for another, or just buying your crypto and then it sits on that exchange for a little bit, or you're doing any sort of centralized product, including like Salt, right? You know what we do, right? Because you have, in order for us to give you a loan, we have to hold the collateral. And so there's risk that comes with any of these sorts of things. And if the security around those platforms is not good, your crypto can get stolen, right? But it's the same, whereas if, you know, if the security around your bank is not good, somebody can hack your bank and steal your dollars as well. It's not the Bitcoin that's actually being compromised. It's the website, the website or the database in just common ways, right? I mean, the majority of these compromises still today come from phishing, where people get access to keys they shouldn't have access to, or the ability to, this is a common one, the ability to access some sort of communication system where they change the wallet address that the money is being sent to, and now it's just being sent to the wrong place. But there's nothing inherently insecure about the Bitcoin network itself that's compromised in these. Jameson and I both mentioned earlier that we sit on the CCSS, which is the Cryptocurrency Security Standards Committee. And the goal of that is actually to help design a standard for security controls around systems and platforms that are dealing with cryptocurrencies, so that these sorts of things don't happen. Because the other place that we see a lot of issues, right, is if you just have a lack of internal operating controls in a business, right? Keys can get lost, and if you don't have good recovery processes for that, the Bitcoin's just gone. It's there, but it's gone. Somebody internally can run off with all of it, if you don't have good operating controls, the same way that they can run off with all of the cash from a bank or any other sort of business. So I'll pause there in case Jameson or anybody else wants to kind of jump in on that.
Well, I think anyone who asks that question themselves has already revealed that they don't understand security, because Bitcoin is not secure. I mean, nothing is secure. You know, security is always a question of accessibility and convenience versus risk. And so, like, the only thing that is perfectly secure is something that is also unusable. So, you know, I can tell people how to perfectly secure their Bitcoin by destroying their private keys in one way or another. That way, no one will be able to, you know, compromise those keys, including yourself. You know, the reason security is a very, very difficult problem, and why it's a good field to be in regardless of the economic environment, is because what we're trying to do is provide a way for the people we want to be able to access sensitive things to be able to do that, but simultaneously, you know, prevent everyone we don't want accessing those systems from doing it. So it's a fine distinction that I think not many people really appreciate, because not many people go around thinking adversarially or thinking from a security mindset. So, Bitcoin as a system is secure, but that's because it's anti-fragile, because the infrastructure of the system in many different ways is very, very distributed. So there's no single point of failure that can be attacked to take down the whole system. Of course, you can attack many different parts of the system and, you know, destroy or degrade pieces of it. You can certainly cause havoc. But when it comes to, you know, being secure against actually having, you know, your funds compromised, lost, stolen, whatever, you know, that comes down to each individual entity and whether or not they're following the best practices. And, you know, that can be challenging to do, as I said, depending on how much value you're trying to secure. Mm-hmm. The more value is at stake, the more resources attackers are going to expend trying to get at that value, and therefore the more diligence you need to put into the, you know, security system that you want to erect around those private keys.
Yeah, no, that's a great point and a great perspective, right? I was thinking of it just from the standpoint of the news stories that people see about, you know, this much Bitcoin was stolen or this much Bitcoin was lost or, you know, but that's a great point, right? I mean, all security is really risk management, right? And it's just the cost to try and compromise something versus the value you're going to get for it.
What I was just thinking is that there are dozens and dozens of movies out there about bank heists and theft and this, but yet there's this conception that banking is the safest place to keep your money. And that if you're using Bitcoin, that there's this great chance of it being lost. But if you put it in a bank, that there's no chance of it being lost. Let's leave the insurance side out of it. But there is not this perfect system, or I don't know, maybe I'm just gullible and believe all of these, you know, armored heist stories, but I do know that they do sometimes happen. But so what about this conception that we should be keeping our money in a bank because that is the best way to secure it? There are tons of people that believe this. I'll call out my mom on this. She's like, what are you doing? Don't you know that I raised you to have a checkbook? And I'm like, what's a checkbook? I haven't used one of those in years. But so there's like these rules set in place. So yeah, Jameson.
Right. So I think an easy way, kind of covering the whole security thing, including, you know, whether you use a custodian, is that anything that can be owned can be stolen. Anything that can be owned can be lost. And if you look at the entirety of classes of attack and loss vectors, you know, we'll focus on private keys here, but every attack and loss vector that can happen under a self-custody model can also happen under a third-party custody model. Additionally, you have a new class of attacks under the third-party custody model that involve, you know, insider attacks of any number of employees at that custodian, or you know, any number of outsiders who may somehow find a vulnerability and be able to get themselves inside the black box of whatever that custodian is. So it's difficult to reason about all of these specific things that could go wrong within a custodian because you don't know what practices they're actually following. And this, I mean, this is why we have C4. This is why we have standards and why we have rolled out the auditor program, is to try to bring some transparency to these black boxes. Even then, you know, it's not perfect, but it's certainly, I think, a lot better than what you're going to be able to get with your traditional financial institutions. You know, compliance is a thing, best practice is a thing. Like, there's all of these, like, you know, SOC related compliance standards that your traditional institutions can try to achieve. Though, you know, I would say a lot of it is really just around auditing and making sure that if something does go wrong, you can figure out what went wrong. I think it's even more challenging in private key management, because it's harder to recover from mistakes. You know, within the banking system, not all of the time, but much of the time, if money is moved and it wasn't supposed to, there's a way to try to claw that money back. So especially if you catch it quickly, and even if you don't, you know, the things that your parents are probably used to is that one positive aspect you could argue that the banking system provides is the socialization of losses. So they're kind of providing a sort of insurance against certain types of losses where you can screw up and lose your money, but you get it back. And of course, this isn't free. We're all paying the costs of this. We're paying costs in terms of fees and bureaucracy and all of the regulations that go along with that. These are all hidden costs. Pros and cons of that versus Bitcoin related stuff is you generally end up paying those costs more transparently and upfront with whatever you're doing. So it's security versus convenience. And unfortunately, I think the default is still today and probably will for the foreseeable future be that people come in to a custodian and never leave, probably because they don't know they have the option or because they are simply too scared to start to climb that mountain of knowledge that is necessary to feel comfortable withdrawing to self-custody.
And I think we have 200 years on top of that of, marketing and advertising, creating this, association with brand and brand loyalty, right, as well, right? So, I mean, there are Chevy people and there are Ford people and there are Coke people and there are Pepsi people and there are Chase people and there are Wells Fargo people. And there, we have this notion just inherently that this is just how it's done, right? And this is kind of one of the challenges with new technology. It's the opposite side of the challenge with the new technology we were talking about earlier too, right? That people are just like, they're inherently resistant to change and this is how you do it. And your mom is like writing checks because she learned to write checks and that's just how you do it, right? And so I think there is just kind of that, until you really understand the benefits of being your own bank, the idea that I can send money to somebody on the other side of the world and they'll have it 10 minutes from now, not 3 days from now, not after paying exorbitant ACH fees, not after the bank just sitting on my money for an extra few days so that they can make a little more interest off of it, until you understand some of the benefits and the value of it, it's easier just to keep doing what you've always done. Sorry, Anita, I think you were going to say something there as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to the notion of banks can be trusted more than Bitcoin or technology can. So if you say to someone here in Zimbabwe, do you trust your bank? They laugh at you because most African people do not trust their banks because either the bureaucracy is high or they don't have access anyhow. Or the fees are here, interestingly enough, much higher than in Europe, for instance. So I think South Africa is one of the countries where banking fees are the highest. And that is where people have least money. And so I think that's also a reason why Bitcoin here has such a fertile ground for adoption, because people don't trust banks and they are actually happy to use something else with which they really can pay borderless and cheap. And that's just an add-on to the thing that we have in our heads in the so-called Western world, that banks can be trusted or are more secure. Yeah, that's not the case here.
I think to that point, one of the interesting things I hear quite often, and I'm sure this will probably make Dirk and Jameson kind of shudder a bit, but is bank level encryption, which it's not really a thing. It's just a term that gets thrown around a lot, like it's ultra secure and super safe. And I think we've kind of touched on the point that that's not a thing. It's just the balance of comfort versus potential loss and usability. So it's one of the ones that I hear quite often, bank level security, bank level encryption, that just people think is like this, upper echelon of security that is the pinnacle of achievement once you've gotten that. But if you're doing some sort of SOC 2 audit or accounting audit or anything like that, you're only good, it's only as good as the auditor. And if anybody's been paying attention to kind of auditor penalties recently, they're not super great at it. So, there's big accounting firms that will charge you an arm and a leg to check a box for you, but that's not really adding value, where, something like the CCSS as an example, shows that there's you know, a better level of understanding, at least, rather than, you know, juniors that kind of are fresh out of school looking through your documentation.
Is bank level encryption like military grade encryption?
Exactly.
I want to build on the concept Rodney brought it up and Dirk had mentioned earlier about risk management. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, this is all about the responsibility that any one of us wants to take on regarding risk management. And for decades, right, we've delegated that risk management to brands that we've trusted or we believed were trustworthy. And now we have opportunities to take, not delegate, and say we want to take control of it. And one of the things that I think is interesting with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, right, is the multi-key signature opportunity. That we can do multi-sig ourselves, we can do multi-sig with a group of people, we could do multi-sig across organizations as a way of taking control of that risk management at different levels and different forms, which is a real change in terms of the solution compared to what we've been used to, and creates the opportunity to migrate the trust from brands and from organizations to processes, which we then can choose how much we participate in.
And I can tell at this point, we're going to have a third one of these, Jessica, because we've barely dented our list of myths.
Yeah, I know. I was noticing that too. I think that at our next live stream, which is on December 1st, what we'll do is tie in more myths, because our plan for that live stream is to talk about this idea that Bitcoin is dead. And Anita, how many times did you say there was like some article or something, didn't you say earlier, or somebody did, that you saw it was like put in the news as Bitcoin is dead a certain number of times? Is that you?
Yeah, 464 times. There's a website like Bitcoin Obituaries, and they are collecting newspaper headlines and articles that are saying Bitcoin is dead. The last was from October 19, and the title is People Still in Crypto Are Like Kamikaze.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to jump into this, what's it called? It's like this drama. Like, people want to latch onto something that's like exciting. I can't think of the word right now, but it's like, oh, it's dead. Like, here's a news flash, right? And so it keeps happening over and over again because newspapers and news sources want to sell articles, and it's the headlines that make it seem like this is this thrilling new thing. But it's funny, if it's been said that many times, you would think that it wasn't that exciting anymore. For me, when I see something about it, I'm like, oh God, here we go again. I just roll my eyes. But I'm sure, you know, 8 years ago when I saw it when I would see it, I would just be like, oh, okay. Like, the people that I know that are working on this, like, I hope that they know what they're doing, which is probably what people say to me now. So it just does take, I feel like, that analytical side and being able to look at what they're saying in the article and recognize that volatility does not mean that it's not useful, and sort of look at the underpinnings more. And so a couple of the topics that we didn't get to today that we wanted to talk about was the volatility of it and how volatility means it's not as useful. We wanted to talk about how Bitcoin isn't being used as a currency, which, Anita, you touched on a little bit, but I do want to talk more about that later. And also the scalability issue and how Bitcoin is scaling, but there's this myth that it isn't. The idea that Bitcoin is only good for individuals sending it one person back and not for companies. And then the big kahuna that Bitcoin is dead. And so we will follow up on December 1st with these myths. If there are other things you've heard about Bitcoin that you're like, is that true or isn't it, put it either in the comments to this video or Twitter, LinkedIn, any of our posts, and we'll try to address that then as well. Dirk, did you want to say anything else about this?
No.
Okay, well, any closing remarks from anyone?
I'd just like to thank Jameson again for joining us today. And as always, appreciate his participation and And like you, right, when I chat, you know, with folks like him, I feel like a total pretender as well. So.
And we have another special guest at our next live stream. Andreas Antonopoulos will be talking about the Bitcoin is dead myth with us. So stick around for that. And yes, Jameson, thank you for volunteering for this committee when you're part of another committee. Likewise to Dirk. I think it says a lot about C4 that we have so many volunteers who are willing to donate your time because you believe in what it is that we're doing and you see education as important. Because I will tell you that not everyone does see education as important. It blows my mind. Maybe that's just because I'm an educator at heart, but it is really the most important piece to this puzzle in terms of everyone starting to learn about it and to be able to use it as making it seem accessible. So thank you all for joining. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you on December 1st for our next live stream. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks, everybody.